closer.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This episode is brought to you in part by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Did you know you can get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today? And all you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/investor. Hello, good day, good morning, good evening. This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. You're listening to, we're almost going to break 100, gang. We're up to episode 91, and I got to think of something special. We'll do something special for 100. Anybody has any ideas, let me know, because you guys have some unbelievable ideas. Boy, you've been shooting me some emails that are unbelievable lately. You know, that ETF discussion we had recently last week was, I mean, wow, you really came up with some interesting calculations in terms of, you know, how, why some of the things that are happening with ETFs, and especially the double inverse and double positives, the two-time beta ETFs. And I thought that, you know, obviously, I was hoping actually we'd have the CEO from ProShares. I hear he's next week. Today, we're going to actually have a great, great interview, at least a great guy with, he writes for what's called the Infectious Greed blog, and his name is Paul Kudrowski. And you probably heard of him. He's been on the show about a year ago to date. So we'll talk with him in a minute. But I wanted to bring you a couple of things, and then we'll get into a discussion with Paul. And then on the back end today, I'm going to give you a stock I want you to look at. Something that we've been investing in and did a lot of research on, and I want to share that with you. But first, I want to talk to you about the quick turn in the markets. You know, a few weeks ago, we had on a gentleman who works with the founder of TrimTabs, Charles Bitterman, and he had talked about how December was probably the worst he has ever seen since he has been tabulating and calculating the employment numbers. And he looks at the employment numbers from a different angle. Whereas the employment BLS looks at, of course, the amount of people that are off work and out of work and fired, et cetera, new people collecting unemployment. He looks at the payroll numbers. He's looking at actually payroll receipts, how much taxes were paid. And the theory is that if he can figure out how much tax were paid and they changed dramatically, well, we know that there's more or less people working. Well, he told us a few weeks ago, you remember this, that they looked awful. And we saw that number last week. From the BLS that came out in the mid-500s, but the revisions, that was the big trick. I told you to watch for these revisions. The revisions bumped the last couple of months up dramatically. But more importantly than all of that, because at first it seemed like it was, oh, it wasn't so bad at first. But then the market really took off on Friday, didn't it? On the downside. Why? One of the things that we saw that the work week numbers were down in terms of the pay. If you look at the actual economic release in its entirety, there was a component in that release that showed the amount of pay, and it kind of broke it down in a way that showed us that there was a lot more layoffs coming. Then we started hearing about additional layoffs throughout the week. Alcoa 13,000. I wrote a piece on MSN that talked about that GM is going to a brand new process of staffing and budgeting. They're calling it zero-based staffing. You want to read about it, it's on the site. But basically, I put this up after the close on Friday. And I got this from an inside source that talked about how, you know, they're starting a new paradigm because they really need to do what they can to make sure they keep their money from the TARP, of course. And that being said, they are going to radically change their overall budgeting and management and oversight. So that means big cuts. So these giant, massive cuts that are coming along with another blow up. We saw Deutsche Bank on their prop desk. You know, the number just came out. It was 500 million. At first, and now it's close to $1 billion loss in a bad credit, I guess, arbitrage or spread deal. And it's absurd. These numbers are getting pretty hot and heavy, and nobody, like we know from long-term capital management, has the corner on understanding completely what these markets are going to do. Nonetheless, the bottom line was that I didn't think, and I told you many, many times, that this market was going to hold right now. And it wasn't going to be a straight line up. We did a big recovery since mid-November. But at this time, I'm really concerned because we keep seeing additional economic deterioration. And that does not bode well. When we look at the S&P 500, and we look at the projected earnings through 2009, maybe into 2010, there's some real concern if you look at the gross earnings. Mish did a piece recently, and he was projecting it's, again, down another 30-40% from where we are now, because when you calculate the future value of the earnings, which I think they're projecting right now at 42, and we know that's coming down, 42 on the index, that is, $42 of earnings. And when you look at that and you take that to its fullest extent and you say, you know, you want to put a just very simply a 20 multiple, we're at 840. But if you bring it down to more like where they usually are, the multiples in recessionary times, we have a bigger problem on our hands. So that's why we've been recommending to be very cautious. Matter of fact, in our TDI managed growth strategy, we flipped midweek, right when Obama was talking. The second he went on, we flipped to a net short position in our portfolio, realizing that was not much that he could really tell us that was going to be dramatic to stem the problems that we're having right now. That doesn't mean the plan's not going to work long term. And as a matter of fact, I think there's some great plays that are, you know, that you could really do for this. But the truth is, he came with 2.5 million jobs that he was going to save, 2.5 million. And then lo and behold, boy, he came up. Now it's going to be 3 million jobs saved, 3 million jobs. And now all of a sudden we hear 4 million. Now the new one is 4 million jobs. His plan is going to save 4 million jobs. How much do you want to bet by the time it's all said and done, they're going to be boasting and clucking about 6 or 7 million jobs that they could save once the economy continues its tailspin, and which is inevitable, it seems, right now. And it's amazing that the posturing and the propaganda that's flowing down from our president-elect right now, and with all due respect to him, I am hoping for the best here. I really am. I'm 100% behind him. But boy, oh boy, the propaganda and the posturing that's going on right now is pretty nauseating. Because you know, I think what they did here in this administration that's about to be installed shortly is they took the playbook from Steve Jobs, right? So remember when Apple was moving higher and higher, and each day we'd hear another little tidbit about Apple this or Apple that, or iTunes this or the iPod that, or the new iPhone, and it was coming out with this. And you know, each day there was more and more information to keep the stock going up and up and up. The PR department was working overtime. They did a great job. It's almost the same with the Obama administration. How many times are we going to hear that this $750 or $800 billion bailout that's going to save 2.5 or 3 or 4 now is the same news every single day? They keep on bringing the same news to us every day. Now, they're moving it around. Now, it's more of a tax cut that they're going to embed inside of there. They're upwards of $300 billion worth of tax cuts and possibly rebates that they're going to put inside of that. So now we're really only looking at maybe a $400 or $500 billion only. A $400 or $500 billion stimulus package in terms of new work. And I don't know how, with the revelation they had last week, but that they were going to provide more tax rebate and tax stimulus, that they all of a sudden popped in another 1.5 million, miraculously, another 1.5 million people that they're going to get back to work. But you know, something is a bit suspect. Let's just say that. Something is just not, you know, sitting right. Bottom line here is that, folks, make sure that you understand about the hedging, what we talked about, right? Make sure that you understand about portfolio protection. Now is not the time. Right now, particularly if we have another leg down, because if we have another leg down, it's going to be nasty. Because we all knew that we were skating on thin ice. You know, think about this for a second, right? When, you know, when we, I think we talked about this a little bit, but when we first saw the situation way back when, I had talked about the sinkhole effect. Remember that? I said there's like a sinkhole developing. We didn't see it really, but there's something underground just disappearing and almost just breaking apart. And once the hole opened, it dragged it all down. The difference now, it's like today it's like a beautiful winter day. The first snow, it's cold out. Not that cold, but cold enough to get things freezing. We see the pond. We look at our friends, we say, hey, you want to go ice skating on the pond? And they say, wait, well, I'm not sure if the pond is, I don't think it's really frozen over yet. We say, oh, come on, it looks great. Let's go on it anyway. And we all know that we're going on that pond. And we know that the probability is that it's kind of very thin, the ice. And when we fall in, we're not surprised at all, are we? We knew we shouldn't have done it in the first place. Now, if you are, you know, a maverick and a cowboy or cowgirl, and you feel you need to get ahead of everybody else and stampede in the markets, great. Do yourself a favor. Use some good sell-stop or hedging or use some options. Do something to protect yourself because, you know, what's the worst can happen? The worst, a couple of points you don't get because you had to pay for your hedge, right? But at the same time, don't believe that everything is just okay. And all of a sudden, 3 or 4 months from now, I was speaking with somebody last week. As a matter of fact, we talked about how, you know, if the markets are doing what they're doing, it's because everybody believes that the recession will be over and pretty much, you know, things will be turning around in about 3 or 4 months. Now, who out of the many, many thousands of people listening right now thinks for 1 second that this whole deal is going to be over in 3 or 4 months? We keep seeing a worldwide problem that keeps being announced every day. Every time that Obama says 4 million jobs, 3 million jobs, and the whole administration talks about the opportunity, someone else in the industry, in the world somewhere, is giving us bad news. You know, and that's just not a good sign. We heard recently people saying, well, when all the bad news is told and it's discounted entirely, that's a bullish sign. Well, that's great. That doesn't mean it has to be bullish forever. We did crack on the ADP report, I believe, on Wednesday, and the Friday report. It hurt. It was ugly. So anyway, I want you to consider all of that. I also want you to consider, if you haven't done so and you hadn't made good on your New Year's resolution, do yourself a favor. Pick up the book over at Amazon. The Disciplined Investor will give you all the tools that you need. That's going to go along with what I'm about to tell you. You'll understand patterns. You'll understand quantitative. How do you find stocks? You know, the screening process. But the other thing I want to mention to you is that on this week's Strategy Lab, we bought some stocks. And again, I'm going to tell you about one of them after we talk with Paul. But we bought some stocks, and I also put up a journal entry that gives you a spreadsheet that you can use. You can download it. You plug in a variety of numbers, and it gives you this, what we call the edge trade, where the volatility is taking things up and down all over the place. It gives you the exact numbers to buy and sell, short and cover. So this gives you an ability to trade an ETF, let's say, or some other instrument, and with pricing points based on two things. Number one, Fibonacci retracements. And number two, we modified it utilizing volatility a la the VIX. So what happens is the greater the VIX, the greater we extended the Fibonacci's in terms of the outlying positions. So if you want to pick that up, go over to the Strategy Lab. I'll put a link on the website on this show notes to how to get there and how to download this Excel worksheet for yourselves. Actually, you know what I'll do? I'll put both links. I'll put the link right on the website, and I'll put the link to the Strategy Lab so you can see it. Last week, some of the stocks that we bought on Wednesday, we went short a few stocks. We went short Almost Family, MasterCard, and long a few, which, again, I'll tell you about in a moment when we get back after we speak with Paul. But we're actually up another 1.5% last week. So I think we're up to 14.7 or 14.8% since August. And the game is almost over. It's looking pretty good, like I'm a clean up here. So we'll see. Finally, if you want to meet me at The Money Show, I want to meet you. We had a great time meeting a lot of people out in D.C. not too long ago. The Money Show is in Orlando. It's February, I think, 4th through 6th. We'll put all the information on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But if you could be there, that's great. If we have enough people to come and enough people that want to, you know, get together, we'll have like a cocktail party. We'll do a little get together, and we'll spend some time, and I'll bring some books with me, and we'll have a good time. So if you want to do so, just go to the website. I will put a form on there or a little link, so you can find out about when the Money Show is in Orlando. It's a great time. Usually the list, this is the biggest one, by the way. If you've never been to one, this is the one you want to go to, okay? So the Money Show in Orlando in February. Harry Dent's going to be there, as a matter of fact, and Markman and Juback, and just a whole slew of people. The whole Strategy Lab, I think most of the Strategy Lab will be there. And we have a conference discussion panel that we're going to be on. I have a class I'm teaching as well. So if you want to do so, check it out. I'd love to see you, and make sure that you get your information. If you're interested in getting together during that time, it'll be probably on the Thursday evening, and it's on February 5th. You know, make sure you come to the website, just put your name in and say you're interested, and we'll make all the arrangements. So as you know, this podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. These guys are clearly the leader in spoken word entertainment. If you're like me, I like to listen to podcasts and listen to books. I just downloaded two of them, as a matter of fact. I downloaded a book on productivity. It's the latest in the series of the Getting Things Done series. And I also just downloaded, I think it was called The Last Speech. I think it was called The Last Speech or The Final Speech. Anyway, I heard it's a really, really good book. And I said, all right, yeah, I'll try it. So, but the thing is, it's so easy because you could kind of multitask. Anyway, what's cool about this also is that they have these programs that are really inexpensive, and they automatically put your subscription, whether it's for you know, maybe the New York Times in the morning, or the Wall Street Journal that's read out loud, or even a book a month you can get. And it's basically, to try it, it's free. It's kind of cool. And they have a huge amount of selection for you. So what I would suggest you to do is very simply, all you have to go is to audiblepodcast.com/investor and simply just go sign up. There's no, you don't have to sign up for any period of time, but if you don't like it, you can always cancel too. And you get a free book. As a matter of fact, you get my book free, The Disciplined Investor, if you want. So check it out, audiblepodcast.com/investor. It's been a while since we had our next guest on, probably close to about a year. And I think that if you have ever listened to Paul Kudrowski from Infectious Greed, you'll know this guy is right on. He is a very creative writer, also very astute when it comes to the markets. And we're very glad to have him today on the Disciplined Investor podcast. So, Paul, tell me something. I know that one of the things that you've been talking about of late is this, you know, this nihilist trade. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me. Sure. So what I was trying to explain, I was talking about this the other day on Fast Money over at CNBC, and the gist of it was that there's an awful lot of naive sort of historical data mining going on. I call it kind of a full employment act for sort of Excel weenies. And and the gist of it is that people look back and they say, you know, in prior recessions, here are the sectors that let us in, here are the sectors that let us out, here's how long on average they lasted, here's how deep on average the downturn was, and so on. And what I've been trying to point out to people, and it got sort of labeled as nihilism on Fast Money, is that that's just a huge mistake. And there's a bunch of reasons why. Foremost among the reasons why, however, is that if you go back sort of over the post-war era and count back sort of the number of bear markets we've seen, you know, it's sort of on the order of about 15 or 16 bear markets, nine of which were sort of sparked by recessions. So let's start there. So when you start seeing people play this game of here's what happened the last time, well, right away you're working from a data set of nine. I mean, you know, if this was a poll, you'd get kicked out of a newspaper.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And the idea that people are committing money based on a data set of nine prior examples is absurd. It's completely meaningless. And it's worse, obviously, once you get inside the data, because once you get inside it, you realize that, say, for example, the average length of a recession or of a bear market caused by a recession, well, across those nine data points, which is, you know, meaningless, they range from as long as short as 90 days to as long as about 900 days. So, you know, the variance, to say you've got an average of, let's say, 500 is completely meaningless when the variance in the thing is so giant that essentially it could be anywhere between sort of 0 and 1,000 days on average. And that's even assuming that what we've currently seen is in any way similar to the last nine recessions, which, of course, the answer is it's not, because
right.
The last bunch of set of recessions we've had have largely been sort of traditional business cycle recessions, as opposed to a consumer-led credit revaluation and deleveraging, which has really happened maybe one and a half times this century.
Well, so, not to mention the fact. Let's also bring to the point that the numbers. I mean, the absolute numbers here are extraordinary. I mean,
sure.
We are. How much more desensitized can we be to the word billions?
It's really astounding. I mean, a year ago, or not even a year ago, 6 months ago, when we first, and a great example is when we first started talking about stimulus packages, the first stimulus package went through, I guess, just late spring, early summer, and we were talking about that initial stimulus package, which was, you know, merely a few hundred billion dollars. And then the idea at the time was floated that potentially by the end of this, we might be talking about, you know, at least another stimulus package of the same amount and, you know, perhaps as much as $500 or $600 billion. That now seems like chump change because, you know, the numbers with respect, we throw around blithely as if, you know, they just come out of thin air, have grown and grown and grown, and we've become completely desensitized to it. And it's got systemic consequences. And again, this goes back to this nihilist idea that what we forget to think about is that what we've learned through this crisis is that everything that's going on, that the global financial system is so tightly coupled that, you know, tiny perturbations in one part of the world go, you know, swinging across the globe and cause problems everywhere else. Think about the consequences of this giant mass movement to Keynesianism. So all of a sudden what's happened is that every OECD country is simultaneously in a synchronized recession and all at the same time are trying to play Keynesians. Many of these countries are current account deficit countries, so they're all out in global debt markets, such as those global debt markets exist, all trying to raise money simultaneously to fund these stimulus programs and bailout programs around the world. And so what you're seeing is almost a 10x increase over the last 3 years in terms of the amount of money that developed countries are trying to raise in global debt markets, sovereigns are trying to raise. And think about the consequences of that. It's not just that money's hard to obtain and just that long rates are probably unlikely to go up. think about it, if you're a developing country that's out there as a current account deficit developing country that requires access to global debt markets, you're screwed.
Yeah, screwed is the word I was thinking, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because yeah. It's a classic crowding out problem. All of us, you know, big, fast-talking countries around the world that are out there raising money look much safer than any of these small developing markets. And so if you're in Ecuador or you're in Ukraine or, you know, even potentially some of the other Eastern European countries, you're in big trouble because you're trying to get access to the same debt markets that we're busy squeezing you out of. So these are all these systemic consequences of not thinking about things and becoming desensitized to the size of the numbers.
Well, here's also what I think is interesting. You know, when you look at the dollar, you know, oh, the dollar in relation to this. And I said, well, let's stop for a second. Picture for a moment a world where the various currencies were not necessarily priced on a relational basis, right? So, you know, you just had like an absolute value if there was such a thing. And think about for a moment, where would the dollar be at this point? It'd be in the toilet.
Right.
I mean, it would be a devalued currency that was laughable.
Right. In a sense, and this is a thing that people seem to miss, because there's always this conversation about what happens if the Chinese stop buying, which is an absurd point, because in a sense, the Chinese can't stop buying. We're in a death hug with the Chinese with respect to sovereign debt from the treasuries here in the U.S., because you know they are now ahead of Japan, the largest holders of U.S. sovereign debt in the world, and they simply can't afford to have that debt simply get washed out. So the idea that China, for example, is going to simply abandon U.S. debt is crazy. But the problem is that that's in some ways even worse, because what happens is, as you say, instead of being washed out, we have this kind of weird false embrace going on of the currency that's supporting it at levels that don't make any sense were the currency to trade according to properly appropriate value.
Right. Well, then again, nor would any of the other countries. But so that's where that whole
the whole thing is a kind of lock embrace around the planet. And so what we're heading towards, though, and this is the dangerous part, is people talk about how we've learned all of the lessons of the prior the Great Depression, like for example, the dangers of protectionism and Smoot-Hawley and what have you. And that's absolutely true, but that doesn't mean we can't make different mistakes that have the same consequences. And the one that I'm most concerned about, and it's apropos of this point with respect to global currencies, is what's really trying to happen is actually most countries in the world are simultaneously trying to devalue their currencies. We'd all like to devalue our currencies at once, in part because we want to make sure that whatever debt we have out there that we're monetizing it, as the euphemism goes, and so we don't have to pay as much. But it's also because we'd like to become much more active exporters to support.
Yeah, but it's like the corner gas station war.
Yeah, you can't play that game.
Right.
You can't play that game.
Right. Eventually, you go broke.
Right. It's the same way that everyone in the world can't be Keynesians at once. We can't all devalue our currencies at once, because what it turns into is a species of protectionism, no different than instituting Smoot-Hawley, and everyone then is caught in a just a different kind of trade war that happens to flow through currencies.
I think last week or the week before, I had Peter Schiff on, who is a relatively outspoken fellow. Now, I heard him say, I really do believe that I heard him say that you need to be careful because the dollar is going to zero, and which is right what we just talked about. And I mean, is this kind of a, if you choose to answer this if you want, but is this a publicity stunt to get a lot of attention, or is this something that you really think he believes, or is this something totally different that I'm missing?
Well, Peter's great at coming up with these provocative things, and I mean, he's been right, so, you got to pay attention. I think it's obviously unlikely the dollar goes to zero, because it's kind of like the apocalypse trade. It's like saying, I bought a credit default swap on the U.S. Well, fine, but who's the counterparty?
Right, exactly.
The U.S. defaults on its debt, who's paying you?
Right.
Similarly, the U.S. dollar goes to zero, what is it exactly that you suppose that the rest of the world is doing while that happens? So, having said that, however, I think it's a really useful thought experiment to say, what if the U.S. dollar is half of its current value with respect to other major currencies? And that's a very realistic thought experiment to play. Now, that doesn't mean it goes to zero, but it does mean that the U.S. ends up becomes a highly inflationary environment. Lots of people shy away from U.S. debt because it's essentially being monetized. And, we become kind of a pariah in global debt markets. And that's an experiment definitely worth considering.
Mm. So I do have a question that's been really bugging me. And I've yet to get an answer, and I will get to the bottom of this eventually, because it's one of those things that's just really gnawing at me. ETFs are beginning. This is also back to your discussion about, you know, the Excel geek and kind of coming up with all sorts of scenarios and you know, there's this, these double ETFs, these inverse and these partially correlated, which frankly I understand how they could be detrimental to a portfolio if we have these weird volatile trades. I get more email of people showing me one day it's at 100, one day it's 105, then it's 100, then 105, and look how the index made zero and the negatively inverse correlation did, you know, negative 10% for the period. I said, well, just flip the upside and downside the first day, and we get a different result in the 11th day.
Right.
But more,
right.
But more so, I understand also the correlation issue, correlation issues, and the fact that probably sometime in October, November, the cost of buying the swaps, it was a much higher level. Just like volatility will increase the cost of an option, so we have to keep that in mind. But there has been further discussion that there is some kind of a relationship between the amount of money that is involved in ETFs. Somewhere, some are saying that the 45% of the market's trading is ETFs these days.
Right.
And this weird phenomena, this 3 to 4 o'clock phenomena.
Yeah.
Which is very troubling to me because I just find that, you know, aside from whether I want to trade it or not or whatever, what the heck is going on there?
Yeah, and when your stat, I mean, I've seen similar numbers from people who follow the actual money flows a little more closely than I do, but certainly in excess of 35% of volume is being increasingly tied to exchange traded funds, and which is a pretty remarkable figure. But the more worrisome one in some ways is, as you say, what's been going on in the last hour. You know, the joke increasingly around, you know, a lot of trading floors where I spend time is that, you know, we just need to show up in the last 5 minutes because that's when everything happens. And the trouble is, of course, whenever everything happens in the last 5 minutes, it essentially, you know, makes it a crazy and functionally illiquid market for most of the day, and then a wildly volatile and deranged market in the last 5 minutes, which just causes people to shy away. So, you know, I make the joke all the time that we should probably make the closing time a random variable and have it close, you know, maybe it closes 45 minutes after it opens, maybe it closes 4 hours after it opens.
Yeah.
But the reality,
I remember that. You made a blog post on that. I commented. I thought it was kind of really
closing
wild.
Closing time a random variable. But it was semi-serious in the sense that as everyone targets everything around the closing time, we're all crowding into the exits at the exact same moment. And like any time when everyone's crowding into the exits at the exact same time, it's exceedingly risky and is likely to cause all kinds of, you know, problems in terms of just the sheer ability to process the thing. So I can't imagine that this can get, it can't go much further than it currently has, because the problem now is that the market in the last 20 minutes during these, you know, more active times essentially becomes untradeable. And so people are actively shying away from trading the last half hour, which kind of creates a new problem, is that when do I trade? And so this is a really big problem, but I'm not sure what the solution is, unfortunately.
Well, let me throw this out to you. So let's also say that these wild upswings have been really extraordinary, and I would expect if there was a massive amount of trading, and let's just even call a closing of the trade for a day trade, you'd see both sides. There may be a little bit of a slant in either direction.
Right.
But I mean, to move 400 points in an hour is ridiculous. Okay, on the Dow that is, and all. So how about this as a theory? How about a theory? How about that there is a understanding that ETFs need to square up the trades by the end of the day, and they utilize the various brokerage firms to get their different positioning, whether it's swaps or actual positions in the index, whatever it is, and there is some kind of a possible situation going on that the brokerages are aware of this. And they know that if they get ahead of it, they possibly can have a big ramp up, similar to what happened in the last decade when we saw the mutual funds getting this weird last 15 minute of the trading day push into an international fund, where they saw this arbitrage or this possibility that slants them into maybe a 1 or 2% benefit for the day. Remember that?
Right.
Well, that whole disaster. And that would have been fine, by the way, as long as they didn't have to break the rules.
Yeah.
These creeped one. That would have been fine.
Right, that was a problem.
Yeah, a little. Yeah, exactly. So I mean, what? How about something like that? Because and I'm not putting. If you don't want to answer this, I was all summer just an absolute. I was screaming about this whole Enron loophole issue, and I don't know if you tracked any of my research, but we found an absolute to the day reason why oil dropped. Aside from what happened recently with demand issues.
Right.
We found the absolute day, it was the change of the status of trader, who was a trader and who was a speculator, if you will, from the farmers, who was required to disclose and who wasn't. And if you look at that exact day that the law was changed, is the exact day that the entire thing fell apart. I don't know if you saw that. Yeah, exactly.
No, I didn't see that. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's fundamentally part of the issue here, is that you know, writ large, there are all of these, it's a macro market right now. There's all of these exogenous forces that are driving things. It's not intrinsic value. It's not even momentum in some sense. It's disclosure issues. It's, you know, the participant of large and unusual investors forced to disclose their position or unwind positions. And all of these macro forces are the things that are causing all of the, you know, so much of the volatility that we're seeing. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, as long as, for example, to go back to the government example, it's one of the reasons why I tell people, I mean, you have no business in many ways other than trading under the protection of the government umbrella and saying, you know, these are the, whatever they're buying, I'm buying. Outside of that, you're just getting out whipsawed. And the great example was the GMAC thing that happened with PIMCO at the beginning
of
December.
Oh, boy. Wow. Wow.
There's your classic example is where, you know, PIMCO was going to go, was looking to go, or saying they were going to go one direction with respect to the swap of the debt for equity, and then, you know, announced, I think it was around December 15th, that they were going to go the other way. And of course, that torpedoed the GMAC deal for swapping debt for equity. And of course, then PIMCO benefited because, well, then the Feds had to sail in and bail out GMAC.
It's kind of like when I was a kid, you know, you tap a guy on the shoulder on the other side, they look to the right, you go to the left.
Yeah, no, exactly. How do you play that kind of game? Clearly, PIMCO, you know, will charitably say, had a good sense that were GMAC on the ropes, that the Feds would come in and bail them out. But nobody else felt that way because they were busily swapping debt for equity. And if they felt right. like the Feds were going to bail them out, they wouldn't have swapped debt for equity at 60 cents.
And so it's interesting, they were the only ones who aren't
necessarily that, well, privy to such great insights to supposed to trade that.
No, I find that it is remarkable. And back to our denial discussion, it's remarkable how many people are willing to sit in mutual funds through all of this.
I know.
It is unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, and that's in many ways one of the most saddening things. I hear so many stories from people who've got 6 months now of brokerage reports on their mutual funds. They're sitting there unopened on their desk and they're dreading the day sometime in the next 6-8 weeks around tax time when they have to open all this stuff. There's so many people who haven't, you know, actively said, you know, I need to do something about this because it's not going to get better on its own, and are sitting there just, you know, hoping that something magically changes. And that's a really unfortunate situation. In many ways, it's a condemnation of the entire 401k structure, but that's sort of a separate issue.
Well, that's a good point that you make there, because as a matter of fact, in the piece I just wrote, I'm talking about, I've slammed the mutual funds pretty hard. I mean, really hard. You know, the T. Rowe Prices and all these guys, and more so the entire idea that you as an individual are allowed to make money when the market goes up only.
Yeah.
And you cannot protect yourself down, because not only is there the opportunity to move to cash, but you know what? Thank you, Mr. Buffett, and thank you all these, you know, you're not allowed to sell anything. You know, I always make the joke that GE is bought, never sold. You're not allowed to sell it. You're allowed to buy it. You're not allowed to sell GE, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really a very unfortunate situation because, and people listening are going to, you know, hear me say this again, but, you know, Ken Huebner, the brilliant Mr. Huebner, brilliant guy, I'm sure, but I mean, 50% down. And the one that really just got me last year, that really took me off my edge, was Fidelity Magellan down 50%. That really took me out. I was just freaking out.
Well, you know, and because, of course, the problem is, and people aren't very mathematically inclined, they never think through exactly how long I'm off 50%, how long is it going to take me to recover from that loss 50%. It's not 50% in the other direction that allows me to recover from being down 50%. I mean, for many people, this torpedoes their portfolio worth for life, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, and this is a broader answer, and this goes back to the very beginning of our discussion about the nihilism thing, what I fundamentally argue is there's going to be a new normal on the other side of this, because what investors have been burned into figuring out is that, you know, equities are not unidirectional products. They don't just go up. Real estate isn't a unidirectional product. It doesn't just go up. And so now they have to figure out a way to survive on their own. We've become survivalists in the financial markets. And so what does that mean? It means that people are going to be tilted much more towards cash, much more away from any kind of risky instrument, which means that the kinds of historical price earnings premiums we've been willing to pay for these things go down because the demand goes down. And so applying historical trough multiples, just as an example, is wrongheaded because the world is changing as people go from negative savings rates to 7% and maybe 11% savings rates and say, I don't know, the only thing I know is I have to take care of myself because Fidelity Magellan and everyone else isn't going to do it for me because it's sold as a product that always goes up and it doesn't.
Yeah. So I guess in closing, a couple things. So you what's your general outlook on you know, the markets in general? I mean, not, you know, just generally, what does this look like? I mean, does it look like it's getting, you know, it's still frothy? We took too much of a parabolic move up recently, and there's going to be a little bit of a letdown. I mean, earnings look pathetic.
Yeah, earnings are going to look horrible through most of the year. So the trade data is disastrous. I don't know if you saw the Taiwan data yesterday. I mean, off almost 40%. It's just unbelievable.
I was shocked when I looked at a 3-year chart recently of China's consumption and output. I was shocked that starting 3 years ago it started declining so terribly.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that's and I mean, in some ways, it's a natural response for the Chinese because you know they understand that there's no safety net. They got to take care of themselves, and so the instant they see a sign that you know things are getting the slightest bit wobbly, they're all going to retrench in a major way, and consumption's going to drop off a cliff. Which is you know where they're not like weaned on the idea that being a consumer is right next to citizenship like it is here in the U.S. So no, I feel very much the same way that what's going to happen here is, and I've been sort of saying since sort of November that we were going to see a big move higher into sort of the Obama. In the Obama era, and then sometime in the sort of the February, March, April timeframe, the wheels come off again. We at least go back to the lows of November, and arguably probably penetrate those lows, and then we sort of lose the mythology that the second half of 2009 sees a recovery of any note, and we get into early 2010, and now we start talking about a weak recovery, probably sometime in the middle of 2010, but encumbered entirely by giant amounts of debt and with a considerably weakened dollar.
All right. Hey, did you hear the news about Deutsche Bank?
No, I haven't. I've been out. Was there something this morning?
Yeah, 500. I think it was a $500 million loss on the prop desk. But then again, it's not a billion yet, so it's not.
That's
terrible.
Right. It's call me back when it's over. When it's over a billion, at $500 yeah. million, it's apparently only round off error these
yeah.
days.
Lastly,
prop trading is an unplumbed disaster area for most of the major sell side firms.
Yeah, well, most of them don't even have it anymore. They got
rid
of theirs.
Yeah. So,
Madoff. Tell me about Madoff. You know, in my career, I've been around 20-something years, and you heard the word Madoff, and it was like, oh, Madoff. He's a god. Thank you. You know, everything's good.
Get
into Madoff. It's great. I mean, that was the deal. And we kind of knew how he did things, generally speaking, and a little bit of the trading and all the things he did. But what in the world? How come that there has been no significant, as I see it at least, no significant effect on markets and it's almost like it happened and nobody cares.
Yeah, there's this wonderful compartmentalization thing that's gone on that said, well, that was a one-off. That was unrepresentative of what's going on in the rest of the marketplace. So we can just say, we can make loud noises and we can sort of, scold away and cluck, 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 and then say, you know what, this life moves on. And I think that's entirely wrong-headed. Not because, I believe the extreme case that, it's all Ponzi schemes, blah, blah, blah. No, that's a silly view and it's not helpful. But what it does tell you is that many of the so-called smart money out there is not smart, is very, very cynical, is very naive about what constitutes appropriate due diligence, and is entirely willing in the face of high performance to simply turn its head, go the other way, and accept whatever checks you want to send it. So it just means that the level of cynicism in the marketplace and the absence of diligence combined are so much higher than I think most people expected that it's the only surprise would be if we don't discover many, many more of these. And we're seeing them on a smaller scale already. There was a $50 million Ponzi that sort of unveiled came out the other day. But I mean, this is going to continue. And I think more at a more structural level, what it tells us is that there's lots of reasons to expect, again, that retail investors say the markets, we're back to the view of the 1912-13 period, when equity markets were largely seen as suspect, dubious. Why would you ever want to invest in there? People forget that, prior to sort of the 20s, when the market really took off, most people viewed equity markets as kind of a scheme. I mean, who wants to hang around here? You've got no security. You're at the end of the capital structure. This is all a bunch of promoters. I think we're heading back in that direction, which in many ways is probably appropriate. But
the difference now is we have such a wonderful SEC overseeing things.
Yeah, I know.
Keeping we need a castration is what we need. We need a public castration.
Keeping us all safe from those nasties out there. I mean, but the thing is that it frustrates me. Even the SEC aside, Madoff was such a great example of how fundamentally he was publicly defying the laws of gravity. People could see he was defying the laws of gravity, and nobody cared because they were getting checks. I have no sympathy for people who suspended disbelief in the face of a strategy for which there wasn't even enough capacity in the markets in which he traded.
That was the weird. That's the weird thing. That's the totally weird thing about this.
Right?
Who didn't? Nobody noticed. And the amount of the statements he had to be sending out, it's so bizarre.
No,
I cannot wrap my head around it.
You couldn't run his strategy the way he described it in the markets in which he traded. So my view is that most people who realized that very quickly and still took the check said, well, obviously he's front-running customers from the brokerage firm, so I'm okay with that, but nudge, nudge, wink, wink, I'll never ask. So, come on, don't ask.
Right. Yeah,
I'm happy to accept the checks in the way they go.
You know what I'm saying? I'm seeing a lineup of monkeys, kind of hands over their eyes, ears. You know, we need to bring back that little
I see, hear nothing, see nothing. Yeah. Oh no,
exactly.
Absolutely. And I mean, and that's why in the Madoff case, for me, what it revealed was this weird combination of blind trust in the market, where I trust this guy just because somebody else trusted him, which is insane. And cynicism. It's this bizarre Wall Street-only combination of blind trust in people who give me money and cynicism. And that is a toxic combination that's going to bring down far more things than just, Bernie Madoff and the people who invested in that firm, because it's endemic. It's all over Wall Street.
Yeah, and the fund-to-funds, I have people I know that lost money in that fund-to-funds, the Oppenheimer division, Rye. I mean, was the biggest Shonda. I mean, where you had a fund to funds that may be charging, let's say, 2%, taking all of their money, giving it to Madoff. I mean, that was it's laughable, but it's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. The idea that people, and there were others who weren't even fund to funds, were calling themselves actual, strategies, single or multiple strategy hedge funds, and it turned out their sole strategy was to give all the money to Madoff.
They were scalpers.
I was scalpers. That's exactly right. You end up with stacked fees, and you're scalping customers and pushing the money across into another strategy. It's outrageous. Mm. And I don't think it ends here. I mean, I firmly believe that whatever happens with respect to other Ponzi's, it just reinforces the view that equity markets are, the disreputable cousins of the bond market, if anything, and are a place where people need to put retirement money, which is going to play back in a systemic way into how much money people are willing to put in equity in the future, which changes the values and changes the multiples we should be using.
Yep, and I'd like to see the end of this whole Henry Paulson era, because I just thought of something. I had this kind of wandering thought. That time that he got on his knee recently and begged Pelosi not to let the whole TARP fail. And I was thinking, gosh, what a guy it wasn't a favor of the TARP, but man, he's real. Then I started thinking, I don't know what happened. Maybe I was just, not thinking so clearly. I just thought, wait a second. He was one of the Fast Five involved in the deal to begin with. He must have an overwhelming guilt of that $500 million that he took on the way out.
Well, he hasn't exactly mentioned how guilty he feels, until he does, I'll assume he doesn't feel guilty at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is part of it. I mean, the famous story about Paulson was one of the ones who was pushing most aggressively for the major sell side firms to be released from the leverage requirements, which in a sense allowed them to go out and sachet out with 30x leverage and help cause some of the systemic risk problems that existed in the market. So I mean, the guy he was at the center of most of this, and unfortunately, I don't think. He's never really come clean and said, here are some of the things that I regret and some of the things that I was involved in and made people feel at least he's not trying to play both sides of this, unfortunately.
I have a prediction. He'll do so in his book.
you might be right.
Right?
Maybe saving it for the book. That's entirely possible.
The Paulson Chronicles, how I screwed up. Confessions of a Treasury Secretary.
to be fair to Paulson, I guess I wish he was more candid about those things. Do I think that he's completely messed this up down the path? No, I think he's probably done most of the things that most people in his position would have done. But, in many ways, It just doesn't matter. I mean, it really didn't matter at the end of the day. It's very hard for me to know anymore whether or not we're better off with what we've done than we would have been had we done very little other than letting a bunch of these institutions fail. It's just not clear to me anymore.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, folks, listen, if you want to get some real good stimulating discussion and read the work of Cole Kudrowski, you can go to Infectious Greed. And that's you can just kind of type that into Google and find it. I'll put a link on the site as well. Really good information, outside the box thinking, cynical, but to a point of helping. And I very much appreciate you spending some time today.
Sure, happy to help.
All right, Paul, speak to you soon, buddy.
Yeah, bye.
It's good to have Paul on, isn't it? He's a great guy. I would really encourage you to make sure to bookmark an RSS feed or however you get your information to make sure to really lock on to Paul Kudrowski, because his website, Infectious Greed, is awesome. Okay. I told you that we were going to talk about a stock, and I want to show you. We found something I thought was really interesting. I've been looking for companies who have been, that potentially could really profit from this whole, Obama plan. And what is that Obama plan, right? So that Obama plan is all about getting people back to work, we know, 4 million, as we said before, And it's going to be done in building highways and roads and, you know, tunnels and bridges and whatever else seems to be working. Well, that's interesting. And we put up a list recently of things that we had liked to invest in. But I was thinking as I was looking through this list, we came up with a list of Obama stocks. But one of the things we found was a company in the agricultural business. Now, follow me here for a second. This is a stock that did very well for a while. But of course, you know, if you've seen anything in the agricultural business, I mean, this thing went from, I don't know, in the 20s from 2003 through 2007. And all of a sudden, in mid-2007, started taking a spike all the way up to about 120. Had a double top, a perfect double top, as a matter of fact, in the middle of 2008. And then, as we know, things kind of get a little nutty. And all of a sudden, we saw this stock go from about 120 down to about in the 20s or low 30s. Now, it was probably, I think the low was about 29 and change. And what's interesting about this is the company's called Lindsay Corporation. LNN is a symbol. Now, of course, don't go out and buy this right now. You know, and you know, we did buy this for our clients, but I want to kind of talk to you about this a little bit. What was interesting about this company, if you look at the stock itself, what's really cool about this is that they're an agricultural company. They make these sprinklers, these gigantic sprinkler systems that go out, I don't know, for a quarter mile, and they have all these automatic, I guess we'd call them mini movers, you know, wheeled engines that move them throughout the farms. So this is big stuff here. We're not talking about the little stuff, the big stuff. And this company, what was really neat about them was not that. That was good on its own. I liked it. Their earnings looked good. When we pulled them up through our screening, they looked good. Everything looked good. And frankly, they were so oversold in our opinion. There was a real upside here. But here's what's really interesting, what I liked about this company. What I thought was really cool was that they, if you look at what they did, they have a division that does infrastructure, right? And you really can see this from the outside, but they have this system that does barrier systems, right? They have, if you're driving down the road and you see the concrete slabs that intersect the roads and make another lane, if you will, this is what they have. As a matter of fact, I'd encourage you to check out their website, which is lindsay.com, LINDSAY.com, because if you go and find the infrastructure division, which is a little hidden, frankly, you will see some of the things they do. They have these giant trucks that have extension arms, and on them they have the concrete slabs that can lay down a full diverted lane for on the highways for when there's workers there and when they're working. Now, think about that for a second. Whether it's a bridge tunnel, whether it's a roadway, whatever it may be, we're going to need to have a major amount of diverters in play, right? I think so. So this company has a tremendous division there. Now, I also believe that the irrigation side of the company can do really well. But the part that I like, which is where they have the movable barriers and traffic lane management, crash cushions, they have these things called preformed reflective paving tapes, and all sorts of safety devices for the roads. This is kind of cool. This fits right in there. We bought ACM, which is AECOM Technologies, because we liked that they were an engineering firm that deals with the whole area of really working with civil engineering, if you will. And we bought that at 17. It's in the 29s now, close to 30. And this was not too long ago. If you look for not only companies that meet the criteria from a bottoms up, which is the fundamental and looking at the technicals, but look at a macro play like the Obama plan, you come up with names like possibly, crazy as it may sound, Oshkosh, right? You know, overalls. More so, we like Timberland for the boots. I mean, it sounds crazy. Those are crazy little outskirt plays, but they're interesting. We also like some of the other infrastructure plays. There's a few companies that they specialize in the cleaning and developing and resurfacing internally of underground pipes. Now, wait a minute. If we have to expand our water systems, we're going to need companies that could do those kind of things. There's a company in Brazil that makes the steel rods that is the basic way that they put together stabilized or concrete systems. When they pour concrete and they have reinforced concrete, they put these steel rods in them. There's a company that does that. Very interesting kind of place. These are the places that, if nothing else, think about this for a second. If the entire market goes down the tubes, we are still going to have billions, hundreds of billions of dollars being poured into this entire infrastructure thing, as long as it passes Congress, right? So at least there's going to be some earnings coming into these companies. So you could feel almost like it's kind of a, a backstop from any of these companies that you're invested in. Now, at the same time, be careful because you need to make sure you have good sell stops on these. We've expanded them a little bit, maybe 8%, something like that, you know, a trailing stop if you want. But I think that if you look at some of these infrastructure plays, and some of those, like I said, are at the MSN Strategy Lab, we made some decent money. The down days last week, they were up. The up days, they were up. And so also were our shorts. We're short MasterCard again. I don't know how long we'll hold it, but we got about 12 points on it last week already. We're short Almost Family, which was the real love of many people. They're in the business of taking care of seniors and in nursing homes. And they look a little overdone at this point. If you look at the small cap that really has had a tremendous run, but their earnings are starting to slow as we see it. And the play right now is a little bit more, they want a little more people. It looks like investors want a little bit more, I'll say, safety. So they're going to find things like an infrastructure play. Now, that seems kind of too easy on one hand. You know, well, we know that, like, duh, right? The infrastructure play, how long can that go on? But I think that some of these names are really outstanding. And we are seriously considering the agricultural sector that has been just obliterated. And I think it's an excellent opportunity to take a look at that. So, look at these stocks. I'll put a list of them on the website and at thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes for this episode. And again, be careful. Some of these have run up. Some of these are a little bit toppy, but I think there's some opportunity to trade in and out of these things. With that, we're going to say goodbye for today. I'm going to, hopefully, it looks like we have Mr. Safer from ProShares next week on. And we're going to find out if this thing's, also, we've commissioned somebody to do a study on ETFs to find out what's going on, if there is some kind of an ETF phenomena, whereas the end of day volatility has been attributable to them, which some of it is, we know, but you know, how much, and is this being gamed at all? Because it appears it is. And I'm also going to put out my predictions. If you haven't seen my predictions last year, I think you'd be pretty shocked what I put out in February, what was going to happen. And I think pretty much out of the 12 or 14 things I put up, it's most of them hit. And I think that I have a few things in mind also this year, and some of them a little bit outlandish, but I think there's a great opportunity to make some money from these things. So we'll put those up shortly. If you haven't been visiting the site, please make sure to do so. And finally, I will say that if you would do me a favor kindly and tell a friend about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. If you made some money, make sure to tell somebody about it. You know, kind of we're doing this and working real hard at this to kind of, of course, help you and get you to know who we are so that, we got books available and, of course, the money management business. And if you haven't checked that out, check out the virtual tour on the Disciplined Investor website. Boy, we're going to update it, I think, this week. So if you saw it before, we're going to put an update on it. And we're knocking them dead. Had a real good month so far. Market's down. We're up again. Last month, we were slightly down. But since July 1st, when we started, we're up about, 4% now. Nothing to sneeze about, but the market's down about 35% since. But that's just an approximation, and find out more, and you got to read all the disclaimers and all that by the virtual tour. It's 14 minutes if you want to check it out. Anyway, thanks for listening. I hope to see you at the Money Show. Hopefully, you can get there. And again, be safe out there because the market is getting a little bit spotty again compared to where it was, as it looks so nice in the end of December. Thanks for listening. We'll see you real soon on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.